In this episode, I speak with Christina Keim, author of Unwanted, The Causes and Effects of America's Horse Population Crisis. This is a book that every horse lover needs to read, and I'm so happy to share this conversation with you. It's a subject that's uncomfortable to look at, but necessary. So here we go, episode 236, Unwanted with Christina Keim. Christina Keim is an award-winning equestrian journalist and professional horsewoman with over 25 years' experience in the industry. Her written work has appeared extensively in top equestrian publications, and she's the author of the new book, Unwanted, The Causes and Effects of America's Horse Population Crisis. For nearly 20 years, a top intercollegiate hunter seat coach, Ms. Keim now teaches compassionate horsemanship and offers equestrian yoga and mounted mindfulness sessions both on the road and out of her Cold Moon Farm in Rochester, New Hampshire. I hope you enjoy this conversation. We're just going to get right to it. Hi, I'm Karen Rolfe, and welcome to Horse Training in Harmony. This podcast is about you making progress with your horse in a way that you both can love. It's about learning how to move and be in harmony. Because yes, you really can develop a horse to be both athletic and happy. When we show up as our best selves for our horses will show up for us. So, let's get started. All right, Christina Keim, thank you so much for being on my podcast. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Yay, I'm excited to be here.
Yay. So we actually met for the first time at the United States Pony Club Convention, where we were both doing different presentations, and you were part of a presentation on horse welfare, and that's just in the front of my mind, you know, all the time. And and so I was really happy to connect with you, and I felt very honored to get an advanced copy of your amazing book called Unwanted, The Causes and Effects of America's Horse Population Crisis. And so that's what we're going to talk about today.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I have to admit, and I'm sure you get this a lot, but when you asked me and I saw the title, I thought, oh, I can't do this.
Yeah.
It's too hard, you know, and I'm sure most of the audience on a podcast called Horse Training in Harmony, you know, we care a lot, and it's like, we know, I'm thinking like, I know, I'm doing my part. I don't want to look at it.
Yeah.
But so quickly, when I started reading, I was so happy that I was reading, and the way you write it really draws you in. And yeah, anyway, so is my response to that title common?
I would say yes, you know, and it's a hard concept to give a quick elevator pitch. What's your book about, right? If you say to folks, well, it's about unwanted horses, you know, I think those of us who care a lot about horses immediately feel squeamish, and we know that it's a hard topic, and it's one we don't want to take a close look at. So what I've been trying to say to people is that the book's really about how we can do a better job taking care of horses that are either at risk or in transition. So these are two terms I define in the book itself, and celebrate some of the amazing work that's already being done. And I really, truly believe that if the equine community can kind of pull back the curtain and take a look at this problem in all its complexity, we can fix it. We can do a much better job for horses across their entire life cycle. So I absolutely 100% understand the aversion and the fear, because there's some really hard stuff. You know, they're really hard questions, and there's some aspects of what happens to horses that we don't want to think about and we don't want to acknowledge. But that doesn't change anything and it doesn't make it better. So
Yeah.
yeah, so you're in good company.
Yeah, and it, I mean, it's a good, I found it a really good emotional and thought experiment for me. And you know, it makes sense that if there's a problem, the way to fix it is we have to look at it. I mean, that just makes sense. And I think the reason it's hard to look at is probably because you care so much, right? The people who care the most are the ones who are going to have the hardest time a lot of the times. And the horses need, you know, the people who care to, you know, get our emotions in gear and take a look. So I really appreciate you doing it. And before we kind of get into the, you know, what's in the book, I'd love to ask, like, what was the process for you to decide to take on this subject the way you did? Because you didn't just like gather statistics, like you went there. And I'd love to hear like how you had the idea, what made you decide to actually do it, and then how you were going to approach creating this.
So the project, honestly, it grew out of what was my thesis for my MFA, which I completed back in 2020. So that was a significant year that some of us may remember things going sideways in. But I actually initially started with this idea of writing an essay, kind of an op-ed style essay about why reopening US-based equine slaughterhouses was not only not the ethical way to handle end-of-life care for animals that don't have other options, but was it was the wrong approach. It was a band-aid. It wasn't going to address the fact that there were animals that were ending up there because they had gone sideways earlier at some other stage. So that's where it started. And then it kind of grew out of that.
Nice little essay. Just an essay.
Just an essay. But what struck me, there were several significant kind of world events that happened, starting with the 2008 major recession and then the closure of the US-based slaughterhouses. There were a couple major things that happened, kind of one thing after the other, that created this kind of buildup, if you will, of horses that really didn't have a lot of great prospects and not a lot of good options of places to go. And that coincided a little bit with the rise of social media. And so we also started to see some of these online auctions and people pulling horses from pens and doing fundraising and crowdsourcing and all those kinds of things. So all of that was kind of building and gaining momentum and had kind of been in play for a bit before I started this project. But it was one of those things as I started to dive into the questions. I'm an equine professional. I've been working in this industry, almost by accident since I graduated from college with a completely unrelated degree. And I didn't know where to find answers to the questions I had. I would hear about rumors around such and such auction, or, oh, that's a scam, or horses aren't really shipping abroad to go to foreign slaughterhouses. Like, I would just hear all of these different stories. And it started to occur to me that if I, as an equine pro, was having trouble sorting fact from fiction, that probably people who just loved horses really weren't going to be able to find answers if they went looking. And as you said earlier, it is an emotional topic and it is something that pulls on the heartstrings if you're a compassionate human being who cares about animals and wants them to have a good quality of life and doesn't want to see these beings suffer. So, it started to become clear to me there was a bigger story to be told. So, I've always divided my time. I've been a horse pro, but I'm also a writer. I've been a journalist for a long time. And so it really became clear to me this was a topic I could take a journalistic approach to and do some digging and start to sort fact from fiction and unpack the complex web that really ties all these different types of energies together to both cause the problem and then hopefully unravel it as well.
Was there anything that I want to think about? Two things. Like, one is the emotional journey for you, or were you able to just kind of go, I'm a journalist, and like be able to put on that hat? So like, that's one thing. Why don't we just start with that? Like, was how was that emotional journey for you? Did you have to kind of like take a deep breath and like, I'm going in, or were you like, I'm on it?
I guess I might be fairly good at compartmentalizing, so that was definitely a piece of it. But I had never been, like, I had never attended one of these livestock auctions that truly, horses are just being bought and sold and traded just like any other kind of barnyard animal. And I'd never been to one in person. I'd heard all these stories. And, in particular, when I visited New Holland, I had heard a lot of horror stories like, don't bring your phone in, don't bring a bag in, don't look like you're taking notes, don't look like you stand out, don't look like you're up to no good, because they'll throw you out, they'll literally grab you and drag you out the door. And so, I had heard all these stories and was a little bit anxious, but at the same time, one of my friends who I'd spoken to, who used to not infrequently go and purchase horses from the New Holland auction, she said, you got to remember, this is a business. This is a place where an item is bought and sold. You have just as much right to be there as anyone else. So, there was a little bit of that. Just going into the unknown, that was always comes with its own kind of trepidation, but combined with just these stories that I'd heard, and I think there were times where the conflicts between animal welfare advocates and sales staff in various places had gotten fairly dicey. So that perhaps was not completely unfounded. That said, there were certainly moments in visiting the auctions in particular where, and I think you can hear it in some of the words I use in the book, just really seeing these horses coming through the chute and knowing there was no buyer for them that was going to give them a soft landing. There was no place for this horse to go other than perhaps into another dealer's manifest list. And that was a really hard thing for me to see and to process and to realize, like, this is happening every week, right? So, but it's an important point. Like, again, you can't pretend it's not happening. I mean, I guess you can pretend it's not happening, but you can't change it. You can't change it if you don't see it and feel it and say, you know what, I think something needs to change here. So those pieces were on the hard side. At the same time, getting to visit some of these other programs that are finding ways to repurpose horses or to give horses a fresh start or to use them in an educational way or in a therapeutic way to help other humans and other animals heal. I mean, it's inspirational, like you're emotional for completely different reasons because you're hearing these stories of, sometimes of humans that have been very badly wounded or have had some very tough things happen, and how these animals that have also gone through maybe some tough moments have allowed them to move forward. So I guess it was a balance between these
Roll
roadblocks.
some might say roller coaster.
That's another. For
But
sure.
I really appreciated the tone that you have in the writing of the book, because it's really like, it feels like you're going, just take my hand, we're gonna get through this. And it wasn't, you didn't, it was a, like, you touch on the emotions, but it's really focused on, hey, here's what I'm seeing, here's what's happening. And you do really just paint the picture without, it would be easy to go in there and really rip our hearts out. But and what's beautiful about that is it was easy to keep reading, and I wanted to keep reading. So I think bravo for
Well, thank you.
handling
And
that.
I wanted the reader to feel like you were kind of on this journey with me, right? That I'm on this journey to ask some questions and to learn more and to better understand. And I wanted the reader to feel like they were with me. And I didn't want it to be so hard that they gave up, that they closed the book and I can't finish this because to me that would be a failure on my part to not carry you through to the finish.
No, well, I think you really succeeded with that. And it's funny, my husband would laugh at me because I'd get the book, I'd sit down, I go, and then I start reading. Like I always had to do that little, here I go. But it was good. I went right through it. And yeah. So is there anything, I'm sure there were lots of things, but what surprised you like in this process? Was there something, anything that you were like, oh, like I was, yeah, surprised by that?
That's a great question. I think a couple of things are notable. I think number one is that some of the people that maybe get portrayed as enemies, if you will, you know, the bad guys, they're really not always that bad, if you will. I'm using air quotes here. Your listeners can't see that, but
Air quote alert.
you know, they're people trying to make a living. They are people with a different perspective around who the horse is and what role he plays. And I think that piece for me, this idea that how an individual sees and perceives the horse is vital to understanding where and how they play a role in this whole matrix. That's really critical because if I may kind of use an example, sometimes people will point a finger at groups like the Amish or Mennonite communities who still use horses in this extremely traditional way, you know, to plow their fields, to take the family to church, to do all the things that we would now maybe use a tractor or something with a combustion engine, right? So they're living and using these horses in a really traditional way. And when those horses come toward end of life or end of usefulness, it's to them, it would be immoral to not then send them into that next stage that livestock goes to, right? That's a waste, if you will. And to understand that it's a very different perspective from what I hold and what I've experienced, but I have never used the horse in this extremely traditional sort of work-based way. So people will sometimes be extremely judgmental, and at the same time, you know, these groups are seeing what they're doing as being extremely appropriate and moral and the right thing to do. I'm not letting this horse linger. I'm not letting this horse continue to live in a life of pain. And this is what happens to livestock at the end of life, is they end up, you know, going on. And again, to understand that that's the perspective, you know, people maybe don't always bat an eye if it's a cow or a pig, and you know, some of us are concerned in that way too. But to just understand that they're equally coming from this place of like, we care about what happens. We just have a different thought on what that end could look like.
And that is, it's a tricky subject. And but I love that you brought up the judgment. And you know, there's situations, no matter what your plan is, there's situations where it can turn out not good. And like, who's to say which is kinder? Because you can always think of another horse who didn't have that situation that was in a worse situation. You know, and I think we're dancing around this word that, you know, we don't want to say, but I don't know, the whole, you know, slaughter issue. And I know, you know, I'm sure you don't have solutions and answers because it's so complex, but I'm curious if you have any ways to share some of the ways to look at that problem. I mean, you just did one, or considerations around it, because it is, it's a head scratcher. And you can really look at it from so many different issues. So we're going to go right to the most emotional part. And then if guy listeners, if you can hang through this part, I promise.
It'll get lighter. It'll get
The
lighter.
hardest part. And then we'll move towards all, but it's a, yeah. And again, I don't expect you to have an answer, but I'm sure you, just like you said, it's like there's some different ways to look at it.
Sure. Well, I think first of all, the good news is that numbers are way down. We don't have the best hard and fast data exactly around how many domestic, meaning US-based horses, so equines, broadly, this could include donkeys, burros, mules, etc. So equines broadly, we don't have the best hard and fast data. It's a little bit of an amalgamation of information collected from US Department of Agriculture statistics and some of the other watchdog groups that pay attention to such things. But when the US-based plants initially closed, we were looking at something on the order of 100,000 to 120,000 US horses were annually going into those facilities, and there were only three of them. So that's pretty significant. Now we're probably talking closer to 20,000. So for me, that's a good thing. Like, we've made some progress. But then the question always that has to follow is, what if we don't want them to end up being shipped abroad to, for example, Mexico, Canada, maybe Europe or Asia? If we don't want them to be shipped abroad, we need to have viable, sustainable, funded alternatives for and other places for those horses to go. So for me, it's a multi-pronged solution, right? We need to understand how horses end up in, we use this phrase, in the pipeline, and we basically mean they're in the slaughter pipeline. They may start at a higher end auction, and then they get sold, and they kind of fall down through the cracks. Not every horse that ends up in these places is broken or lame or aged, and that is a misperception. But there certainly are many animals in the pipeline where probably the failure for that horse happened one or two owners earlier. The horse had a chronic health issue. The horse was aged. The horse, didn't have a lot of great prospects. And we all know it's a whole lot more humane to get an injection than it is to go through everything associated with ending up in the slaughter pipeline, where these animals get grouped together in unfamiliar groups, and they've got the herd dynamics going on, and then maybe they're scrambling to get the limited hay or the limited water in the feedlots, and they're being transported long distances. So there are a lot of elements in that process where things are not great. And sometimes it's a case of, an owner didn't have the financial resources, or they didn't know how to manage the euthanasia, or they just kind of hoped against hope that someone else would maybe take the horse on. I mean, there are so many reasons why people end up putting their horses into that pipeline that have nothing to do with the horse. It has a lot more to do with them, right? So, if we don't want to see that process happening, it has to start sooner, and we have to be a little more effective. And we've made some great strides, and there's some amazing groups working on this. But if cost of a euthanasia is a barrier, then we need to find ways to continue to fund safety net programs that support owners if handling the remains is an issue. I mean, I know these are really hard things to think about, but they're realities when you're dealing with a 1,000-pound, a 1,500-pound animal. There are logistical pieces to end of life care that have to be considered. So if we can kind of remove some of the stricture around those conversations and offer support and maybe try to intervene in a few of those cases before those animals end up in that pipeline, I think we can take that 20,000 and make it even smaller. And then perhaps the animals that still are able to live a decent quality of life will have more options, right? So one of the things that can happen now is advocacy groups or welfare groups, you know, they'll spend their resources handling some of these extreme cases, right? These horses that really have a lot of tough stuff going on, and that's where they're putting all their resources, which is okay, right? In that it alleviates the suffering in some of those animals, but if we can prevent the animals from ending up in that pipeline earlier, we could probably make a change. So I think, you know, addressing the slaughter, shipping and closing borders and things like that's one aspect of it, but it's not the only part of the problem that has to
Absolutely.
be figured out.
And I mean, going from 100,000 to 20,000 is great. And, you know, you can think about, do we don't want to do it here, but then the trip to somewhere else is one more. But I think you're absolutely right. Let's look at that and then go, but the whole answer is how do we get them out of the pipeline? And you mentioned the safety net services. That was something that surprised me. Like, I didn't know that that existed. And I'm like, whoa, how do I not know that that exists? I mean, I felt very fortunate that I haven't had to use something like that, but that the I forget the percentage you said, but I think it's a large percentage of horses who, like you just mentioned, it there's nothing wrong with the horse. It's the family has a financial crisis or some sort of situation where they just can't take care of the horse and they don't know what else to do. And so how do we maybe talk about more about the specific safety net feature services and like we need to get that word out. Like, how do people even find out about that? Because
Absolutely.
that was amazing that that.
And so the concept or the term safety net organization, really, I think initially it was used to describe groups that would offer short-term funding to cover the cost of hay and grain and basic veterinary care and farrier services for owners who have fallen on hard times, right? So we know how life is. Sometimes it always kicks you when you're already down. So, you know, maybe somebody's lost a job and now they're sick and, you know, and things start to pile up and they get behind. And the safety net organization's role was, hey, you know what? This is someone who's going to be okay in the long run. They're just going through a tough patch. So instead of us taking that horse and putting it into a shelter and now taking the shelter's resources, let's pay for the grain, let's pay for the hay, let's give this owner some financial support short term. Will they get over this hump and get back on their feet? And then that horse never has to enter the shelter system. So that was sort of the original concept. And in some cases, depending on the organization's mission and structure, it's even been expanded beyond that. So, you know, there's a way where you might even think of a sheltering organization as another safety net service, right? For again, someone who has a beloved horse that they are literally physically no longer able to care for. And instead of that horse ending up in the pipeline, that horse ends up in a shelter where they can be adopted to a new owner or given short-term sanctuary, whatever that support looks like. And the United Horse Coalition, which is nestled under the American Horse Council, they do a pretty amazing job keeping a database, and it's all organized and searchable by state of different organizations that provide this kind of care. Now, depending on the need and the number of requests they get, they can't necessarily fund everyone's requests 100%, but it is interesting as the United Horse Coalition has kind of kept track of the work of these different groups. They do know that the one request they will fund 100% of the time is euthanasia assistance. So again, when someone's horse is getting to that stage of end of life and they start asking questions like, oh, gee whiz, you know, what do I do now? Or we see occasions where, you know, an aging human and an aging horse are living together, and maybe that aging human now needs to go into a care facility and we have an aging horse. It is generally going to be more humane to allow that horse to rest in the home he's been living in with the people who's cared for him and not put him into the sheltering system at all. But if the finances of that are a barrier, these safety net organizations will step in again with the goal of ensuring that that horse does not end up sliding through the cracks and ending up in the pipeline. So, but you know, in the short term, it's an amazing way of supporting owners. And so your point that you'd never heard of them, I think we need to keep talking about these groups and make people aware of resources like the list on the United Horse Coalition page to know where they can go to get help when things go wrong. And also, again, the not non-judgmental, right? That asking for help is not a sign of weakness. It's not a sign that you're not capable. It's not a sign that you don't care. It's quite the opposite. It means you recognize that if you don't get some support, things are going to go south, and you really need to change the way things are going. So, you know, again, according to a lot of the folks I spoke to in this book, they do think the energy around that is changing, that people are more willing to ask for help. But, you know, I do remember, I think it was Christy at the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, Christy Schulte-Capert, who said that because some owners, you know, they get over their heads, they get behind on bills, they get feeling badly about how their horse is looking because they know they haven't been able to sufficiently meet their needs, they will sometimes delay asking for help because they fear the horse being taken and then ending up in a bad place. And so there still is a bit of a disconnect there that we could do a better job bridging. And I don't, I'm doing this off the top of my head, but I think she said the average horse owner who gets assistance from some of the ASPCA's programs has been looking for help for as long as 18 months before they finally take the plunge and do it. And 18 months is an awful long time for a horse and human to not be feeling really good. So
It is. Yeah, and I feel like this is such an important piece. And you know, there's some, it's hard for humans to ask for help. There's some shame, you know, the fear it's going to be taken away. And this is where we can all play a role, because if I know about it and I see a situation, I'm going to be more apt to go, hey, did you know you can this there's this resource. And already, just because one person says it to another person, there's this feeling of, well, it's okay, because there's at least one person who's not judging me for this. So, you know, we all can play little roles just to spread that information. And if we see something, you know, we often think, how can we help? Well, just giving a piece of information can be a huge help.
Or even, you know, even sharing information about that on your social media where it's not even directed to anyone, right? But maybe somebody is scrolling by and sees it on your feed and goes, "Oh, I didn't know about that. Maybe I'll go investigate," right? And it normalizes that, and it makes it, again, an acceptable conversation to have. And it's really just for the good of the horse. I mean, honest to goodness, a lot of times when we find that the horses are suffering, we find suffering humans right behind them, right? It's not just the horse that's not doing well in those situations. So
Can you just now name the organizations that people could look up for this?
sure. So United Horse Coalition, like I said, they have a pretty extensive list. The ASPCA Right Horse Program has another list, and there's some different types of organizations in there. So not all of them provide financial resources. Some of them may also help connect you with local resources, right? They're networking. The Homes for Horses Coalition, which is underneath the Animal Welfare Institute, they're another organization. And you know, the other group, and they're maybe not featured in this book so much, but the Equus Foundation is another organization that they provide accreditation, and they're a grant making body. And any charity or organization that's been sort of recognized by Equus Foundation, they've gone through some approvals and some investigations. So, like, they again, every organization sort of has a different focus, but those are a few places you could start looking to find something local. But the United Horse Coalition list might be where I would send someone first, because it is one of the most comprehensive lists, and it's really easy to search by state for what is available.
That's awesome. Thank you for that. So the book goes on, and you share lots of people who are really, at the edge of the pipeline and pulling horses from that pipeline. So it's really humans rescuing horses. And then you kind of go all the way through to kind of combos all the way to like where the horses are clearly rescuing the humans. And this is where, it really ends on this beautiful note of the power of the healing that horses do for the humans. So this beautiful full circle thing. I'm just curious. There's so many different organizations and stables and people in that mix. I'm wondering if there were, I'm sure they all stand out for different reasons, but were there any particular people or places that left a big impression on you anywhere along that spectrum?
Oh goodness. I
I know
think
all of them.
every single one. I know it's almost impossible to pick just one. I think, in part three of the book, I highlight everything from the rise of thoroughbred aftercare to Mustangs working with veterans and veterans working with Mustangs that have never been handled and never been gentled and kind of giving them each a fresh start at life. So it's like the broadest spectrum of horses and humans possible. But one of the questions that kind of kept coming into my mind throughout this whole book is, who is the horse today? What role does the horse play today, right? Who is the horse? Who is he? He's not this beast of burden. Again, I'm using my air quotes, guys. He's not this beast of burden doing work for most of us. When we ride, even those of us who enjoy competing and maybe are very serious about it, we're still, this is recreation and pleasure. This is not, it's not life or death, even if it feels like it, right? So he's, if he's not a companion animal and he's not this source of labor, who is he? And as I started to speak to some of these different groups, this theme really started to emerge for me that I think the role the horse is playing today is truly that of healer, and how many people do you know who will tell you, oh, I just had this really challenging day at work, and then I go to the barn and I just stand with my horse and I can feel my heart rate lower and I can feel my respiration start to come back, and you don't even necessarily have to ride. You just exist around them, and they can help to regulate these strong emotions and physical sensations, right? So the stories, I spoke to a formerly incarcerated woman who worked with the Thoroughbred Retirement Program's Foundation's Second Chances program. She'd never been around horses in her entire life, and that was learning that there was an opportunity to work with these retired off-track thoroughbreds at one of their partner farms was that was the piece that led her to turning her life around and making some different choices so she could get back out into the world and be with her family again. I mean, it's just these just amazing stories of the power of the horse. And I think when you experience those things, knowing that some of these horses do not get the best endings in their world, it makes it harder to resonate. And I think that's where the friction comes from.
Hey, I just wanted to take a quick second to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by the Dressage Naturally video classroom. Yeah, that's my program. So if you love this podcast, you will really love the video classroom. It's where you can see me coaching students, narrating my rides on horses, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and so much more. So let's see all these words put into action. Check it out with a 1 week free trial, and then it's just $29 a month after that. So even if you only watch one video a month, it is totally worth it. And we add new content every month. So what are you waiting for? go to dressagenaturally.net/classroom. Okay, now let's get back to the pod. Yeah, interesting. I just, you said earlier, behind every horse in need, there's a human in need, you know, that they're in this position to have the opportunity to heal us. And when you see horses not treated well, it does say a lot about the human, what the human is needing. You know, it's not that they're, you know, no judgment. It's just they're having a bad deal too for some reason. And yeah. And I think you really talk about a lot of different kind of situations horses go in. And I think there was one point where just thinking about, like, if, even if it's a performance barn and the journey, and that's something that touches in my world. It's like, okay, we have a performance horse and then it starts getting older or it has some physical limitation. And then, like, there's a decision point. So now what does that horse do? And then, okay, it's a little older, a little, and then what does it do? And a lot of times these worlds are like, well, I'm just a performance barn and I'm just a, you know, a assisted riding barn. And I think we need to be a little more in flow to be able to adapt or have that horse be able to flow into a different situation. Maybe we create it at home or maybe, you know, I think there's so many decision points along the way for any horse. And if we're ever in the presence of a horse at one of those decision points, I think that's where we, you know, we can all play hopefully a positive role.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, just to speak to the performance end of things, you know, I think sometimes it's about learning. I think in the Thoroughbred Aftercare chapter, we talked about how a lot of trainers have learned, rather than I'm going to run this horse one more time or I'm going to push for one more race, they take that as the point to contact one of the aftercare organizations and say, hey, you know, I think this horse is done. Instead of risking an injury or a catastrophic breakdown on the track, they've learned that the horse has more value, frankly, when they're still able to have another job. And so in the performance world, I think it's about us being a lot better about thinking 5 years down the line, you know, if I do another season with this horse in this division, is that in this horse's long-term best interest? What am I needing to do in terms of maintenance to keep this horse comfortable at this level? Should I maybe instead think about starting to step this horse down so he can have a longer performance career? Because the bottom line is, you know, horses that have a job are going to have better prospects than the ones that are less comfortable or less sound. They just are. So if we can do a better job keeping them in that place for a longer period of time and just continuing to adjust their workloads and expectations, I mean, they don't have to be ridden have a job, if you will, but they need to be at least comfortable enough in their bodies to be able to do horsey things, right? So
yeah, absolutely. It's those little decision points, instead of squeezing the last little bit out of them in the one thing that you do, or, you know, to like look ahead a little bit more and at the bigger picture and where else can that horse go and adapt to.
Right.
So important. As the book goes, then you sort of talk about more of this big picture stuff and how we look at the horses. And I love at the end, you know, we talked about welfare and the five freedoms that are necessary for horse welfare. Can you talk a little bit about those five freedoms?
Sure. So the concept of the five freedoms is actually getting to be a little antique. It evolved in the 60s out of some work in the UK, and around a little bit of outrage, frankly, about how animals were being treated livestock in the slaughter pipeline. So the five freedoms are freedom from hunger and thirst, freedom from discomfort, freedom from pain, injury, and disease, freedom to express normal behavior, and freedom from fear and distress. And those concepts have kind of been expanded now into what we call the five domains and are a little bit more fleshed out. So if you go looking for a more contemporary reference to those points, you may see the domains and they're just a little broader. But The idea is that to ensure an animal's basic well-being and quality of life, those criteria need to be met. Those five things that the horse needs, an opportunity to express the innate horsiness of being a horse. Our horses need social contact. They need to be around other horses. They need to be fed according to their dietary needs. They need to live in an environment where, not to say they don't ever get startled or aware, but in general, they feel easeful. They are able to express normal equine behavior and attitudes. And so, when these concepts came out, they were kind of revolutionary, which is a little embarrassing that as recently as the 1960s that was happening, although I'm not sure humans were treating each other particularly well in the 1960s.
Not all women had those freedoms.
Right. So they were kind of revolutionary, and they really became almost the international basis for animal welfare action and decision making moving forward. When we start to consider our equine friends and how we keep them and how we manage them and how we make decisions at these critical points in their lives, those are the tools we can use really to determine quality of life. And horses live in some pretty amazing places and do some pretty unusual things. Not every horse is going to be living in a 20-acre field grazing on, lovely stemmy grass and all of that, but can we find ways to still meet these needs within the context of where we're living and what we're needing to do for those animals?
Yeah, I mean, they when you read them, like you said, it seems like pretty obvious, but there's a lot of horses you can look at that are not having those freedoms. So it's sometimes really good to just have a simple, basic list that when you look at it, you think, of course.
Right.
And now look at a particular horse, and then it just makes it more powerful if some of those needs are not being met.
Right.
Yeah. So I know you really wanted to emphasize that to give people a feeling of hope, right? So again, this is not a dark book. I didn't think it was a dark book at all, and you really this comes across. So do you? What's your message of hope for people?
What I really, I hope that as people read this book, they're inspired by the work that's being done, that there is a growing awareness that if you love horses, whether you are an equine pro, an amateur, a rider, a spectator, someone who just stops on the station when they see the horse go across the screen on the TV, whatever your connection to horses, you have a role to play here. You have a role to play here. And we all have different skills and strengths that we can bring to the table. So it can be anything from I'm going to send some, my annual donation money is going to go to the safety net organization to help someone else who's having a tough time, or I'm going to share some of these organizations' posts on my social media to help spread the word, or maybe I'm a trainer and I have the skills to work with a slightly older horse that's never been handled, never got a correct start, and so one training horse I take in a year, I'm doing on behalf of one of these rescue organizations, right? So what skills do you have? What resources do you have? We all have something we can bring to the table. Even just having this conversation, right? Even just normalizing discussion around humane end of life considerations and knowing that if you own a horse, they don't necessarily have to be old for things to go wrong, but to really be realistic about what is possible, what can you do, what are your long-term thoughts in terms of how I can ensure this animal does not end up falling through the cracks, right? What is my responsibility? How do I play that role?
I love that. Yeah. That there, yeah, there's so many different, we all have our little moments that we can be a help in. And I found this quote the other day, and I think it's really appropriate for this. It was by, and I'm probably not going to say her name right, but it's Ilya Prigogine, and she's a Nobel Prize winning chemist. And she says, when a complex system is far from equilibrium, small islands of coherence have the capacity to shift the entire system to a higher order.
Wow.
And when you're talking about us all having a role, that's really, that reminded me of that. Like, we all don't underestimate the ripples
Right. Right.
effect.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Kind of just gave me chills.
Oh. Well, I'd love to. I've never read somebody's book out loud in front of them. So I was like, oh, I want to read the last part of your book. And you very nicely said I could. Do you mind if I read? I
Please,
just want to,
please.
it's a few paragraphs, but it's so powerful. Just, if we want to ensure that no horses end up unwanted, we must use our considerable collective knowledge, skill, and wisdom to make the best decisions possible for each individual animal at every step of that animal's journey. What does that look like? I don't profess to have all the answers, but I would offer you this. It will require a cultural shift across the industry from the grassroots up, I expect. It will look like everyday horse lovers, people like you and me, saying, enough. Each of us has the ability to make simple changes in how we think about a horse's life and well-being to affect powerful change. It starts with doing better for the individual horse or horses we care for or love or admire. In speaking with many sources whose stories have appeared in these pages, one consistent theme emerged: hope. Despite what might at times seem like insurmountable odds, the advocates, the rescuers, the lobbyists, executive directors, trainers, owners, horse lovers you have met in this unwanted are all operating from a belief that we can make a difference. We can change things for horses at risk or in transition, but we'll take each and every one of us, setting aside gross differences and coming back to the one fundamental core value we share. We each love the horse. My fervent hope is that after reading these stories and pondering the questions raised, you too will believe that you can make a difference for horses. It's not my place to tell you what the first steps look like. I only ask that you're willing to take it. So that is just so beautifully written. And yeah, it makes me emotional just reading that. I'm like, I can do it. I can do it. I can get through this.
Yeah,
But
and
yeah,
I believe
it's.
it. I believe it. I really do believe it. I do believe we can make it better.
I do, for sure. And again, that ripple effect, that island of coherence, it's when we see horses in an uncomfortable situation, we all know it. And there's often people around who might not know what to do, but they can feel that something's not right. And there's something else. And often all it takes is one person to go, huh, I wonder what could be different, or I wonder what we could do, or hey, do you need any help, or
Right.
whatever that little step is. Or like you said, the donation to the right organization who's going to go out and know what to do.
Right.
Anyway, thank you so much for coming on the pod and
Thank you for
talking
inviting
about
me.
this. Yeah, so Unwanted, and it's published by Trafalgar Square, and it is out now. And where can people find out more about you, or yeah, get the book, or how do you want people to contact you if they need
Well, if you
to?
want to order the book, best is and easiest is to go to horseandriderbooks.com and order it directly from the publisher and support your local your local grassroots publishers. If you want to know more about me, you can visit my website, which is christinakime.com, and I post about my writing work there and my horse work and everything else. So I'm always happy to continue the conversation and to learn more and tell more stories. So,
Awesome. Well, and I'll post a link to your website and everything in the show notes. And yeah, thank you again. And I look forward to speaking with you again sometime soon.
absolutely. Thank you so
Great.
much.
If this episode resonates with you, make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening. Training horses is a long game. The more you listen, the more pieces of the puzzle you'll have. To see all your learning resources, visit dressagenaturally.net. That's where you'll find free videos, online courses, my book, You can sign up for my Wednesday Wisdom email or even book a private consult. Most of all, remember, you got this. Never underestimate the possibility for things to improve in ways you cannot yet imagine. Till next time, love your horse, move in harmony, and enjoy the process.